Please listen carefully.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Optimist Daily Update. I'm Christy Jansen.
And I'm Summers McKay.
And we're part of the team behind The Optimist Daily, making solutions the news. We bring you reader-funded, positive news stories every day in order to change the tenor of news media and the direction of your day to one focused on solutions.
Every weekday, we publish 10 stories written by award-winning journalists and delivered online to your inbox and through our social channels. And now, we are sharing these solutions in a commute-worthy, walk-worthy, home office and kitchen stress-baking-worthy podcast.
By subscribing, listening to, reading, and sharing The Optimist Daily, you are on the front lines of action-oriented steps towards solving our world's biggest problems. First you, and then 100,000, and then 100 million people focused on solutions will change the world for good.
Today is April Fool's Day, April 1st, 2020.
And here are today's top solutions. We're starting off from one in our lifestyle section on The Optimist Daily, an astronaut's guide to surviving isolation. If you're struggling to remain positive while social distancing, consider watching a space film to put your quarantine in perspective. All jokes aside, many astronauts are used to spending extended periods of time in isolation, sometimes up to a year. A few astronauts have weighed in on staying busy and sane during weeks or months of isolation. And here are a few tips from space station experts. Peggy Whitson broke the record for most cumulative days in space after spending 665 days aboard the International Space Station. She says it is important to establish a functional living routine with those around you. According to Whitson, NASA even trains astronauts on communication and collaboration techniques to help them get along with others on board. What did she do to pass the time? Whitson said she did everything that had been in the back of her mind that she hadn't had time to get around to. She recommends doing that thing you have always wanted to do, but have not had time for, like reading more or writing poetry. Anne McClain emphasizes the importance of mastering what astronauts call expeditionary behavior, or speaking so you are clearly understood and listening actively. This sounds easy, but simple communication can often be difficult to master. She also writes about the importance of spreading positivity in the group while making sure your own needs are being met. Respect roles, responsibilities, and workload. Take accountability. Give praise freely, she says. Veteran NASA astronaut Scott Kelly says to follow a routine and slow down. A set schedule will help people adjust to the new living style. Kelly says that he and crewmates also took time to set up movie nights, complete with snacks, and to take breaks together. He says reading, playing instruments, and keeping a journal are all great ways to pass the time. Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield uploaded a video with some of his best isolation advice from a more analytical perspective. He says, once you understand the risk and your mission, your sense of purpose and your obligation, then take action. Start doing things. He also emphasizes how internet access opens a wide world of opportunities during isolation. We have a vast literary resource right at our fingertips. Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, didn't have too much to say on the topic. The famous astronaut turned 90 last week, and his advice in the time of COVID-19 is simple. Stay home. It's normal to feel a little stir-crazy at the moment, but keep yourself busy with new activities and, as Hadfield says, take care of yourself, take care of your family, take care of your friends, and take care of your spaceship. And Summers, I love this idea of turning to these people who have been trained and who have spent months or years at a time in tight isolation, usually with another couple of people, where there's nowhere to go. There really isn't anywhere to go when you're out in space. So that's a little bit, some of us feel that way right now, but we have so much more than that, you know, with our windows and the birds are chirping outside my door right now. So I can just appreciate those kinds of outlets.
There's a lot to appreciate that we are not stuck in space. So I love Buzz Aldrin. He's just such a sage guy. Stay at home, people. Just stay at home. All right. Well, taking another direction with today's solutions, we're going to the furry creatures. In the environment section of the Optimist Daily, the Mexican gray wolf population in the U.S. rose sharply in 2019. Exciting news from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In a recent census, researchers discovered that the U.S. population of endangered Mexican gray wolves jumped by 24% last year. That's especially exciting for conservationists who have not seen a leap in numbers that high since 2014. The recent census found 163 Mexican wolves in the wild in New Mexico and Arizona, compared to only 131 in 2018. At least 21 of the 28 packs being monitored had pups last spring. The survival rate for those pups was higher than usual, reaching 58% last year, compared to an average of about 50%. Gray wolves have historically been targeted by ranchers trying to protect their livestock. The Mexican gray wolf is now the rarest subspecies gray wolves in North America after it was nearly wiped out in the American Southwest by the 1970s. The sparked effort to save them that included breeding pups in captivity and releasing them into the wild. 12 pups born in captivity were placed in wild dens last year by the same task force of federal, state, tribal, and international partners that conducted the census. It was able to find two of those pups since releasing them and is still looking for the others that may have survived. In the future, releasing entire families of wolves instead of just pups could increase the chance of those born in captivity surviving in the wild. Conservation group, the Center for Biological Diversity, said in a statement, "All in all, the conservationists hope that the introduction of wolves bred in captivity will boost wolves' genetic diversity, as inbreeding has also been seen as a pretty big problem."
And this is great. I think wolves are one of those cornerstone species, Summers, that can help entire ecosystems get repaired in a case when there's lots of damage to the ecosystems. You know, I'm a dog lover. So, all right. Well, another story from our environment section today, in also looking at how citizen science has really come back, self-isolation has been a surprising boost for citizen science. The Rainfall Rescue Project was launched in the UK just last week to help scientists understand past rainfall variations. And a big part of doing that requires digitizing old written records. In what can be considered a little silver lining of coronavirus pandemic, scientists have been amazed as self-isolated public volunteers have blitzed their way through rain gauge data from the 1950s, 40s, and 30s in just 4 days. Project leader Professor Ed Hawkins had suggested the work might be a good way for people to use their self-isolation time. It seems he was right, as nearly 12,000 volunteers signed up to help scientists sift through data in previous research articles. Buried in this massive data is information that can inform flood and drought planning. The data is also accompanied by notes that explain certain statistics. There are stories of data being interrupted by trampling animals and of children throwing stones at the gauges. On one sheet from 1948, the abbot says his monastery's time series was interrupted because the gauge had a bullet hole in it and needed repair. The importance of recovering old weather records can't be overstated. It's only by putting the present in the context of the past that we can plan properly for the future.
I love it. And I love the history of that science as it shows up there as well. Okay, another solution in the design section. This is returning to our COVID-19 coverage. Designers to convert shipping containers into intensive care units. Containers may have revolutionized the shipping industry, but lately it seems that their efficiency is finding its use beyond freight transportation and toward ingenious healthcare units. 2 days ago, we wrote about a company that is using shipping containers as decontamination rooms to sanitize personal protective equipment so that frontline workers fighting the COVID-19 pandemic stay safe. Now, the large steel boxes could offer hospitals overwhelmed by the ongoing outbreak a much-needed capacity lifeline, thanks to an inventive retrofit design developed by an international task force. In collaboration with an interdisciplinary group of professionals, innovation firm Carlo Ratti Associati, CRA, has unveiled a model that converts shipping containers into plug-in intensive care pods as part of a larger open-source design project named Cura, Connected Units for Respiratory Ailment. For quick deployment, the plug-in units will be repurposed from 20-foot-long shipping containers that can easily be transported anywhere around the world using existing transportation infrastructure. And, according to the designers, Cura is as fast to set up like a tent, but as safe as an isolation ward, thanks to biocontainment with negative pressure that complies with the standards of airborne infection isolation rooms. The individual pods are all separated from each other, but can be connected with inflatable structures to create multiple configurations ranging from 4 to over 40 beds. And thanks to its modularity, the flexible design allows pods to be installed in close proximity to the hospitals in areas such as parking lots or standalone makeshift emergency hospitals, and open fields and town squares. As a ready-to-use solution, each CuraPod is equipped with all the medical equipment needed for two COVID-19 intensive care patients, including ventilators and intravenous fluid stands before deployment. The first Cura prototype is currently being built for testing at a Milan hospital.
And this is a wonderful solution, Summers, and it just shows how once we get focused on a problem, we can really come up with innovative, quick turnaround solutions that can make a huge difference. And this is something that being developed right now can then be deployed in future problems, you know, not related to the current crisis.
We're really looking hard at the Optimist Daily on solutions that are coming out with long-term positive ramifications from this very, very crazy time for our world. And we just salute the innovators and those who are thinking hard every day about how to solve and create new networks of opportunity and networks of health and wellness for our future. Thank you to everyone who is being creative and using their brains and solving these world problems.
I wholeheartedly support that statement. Thank you, Summers. All right, well, in our final article for today from our environment section, it's about how methane-loving microbes may help reduce emissions from melting permafrost. As the climate warms up, polar ice and glaciers aren't the only things at risk of melting. Permafrost, the frozen layer of soil that underlies the Arctic tundra, is beginning to thaw as well, with scientists concerned that this will release huge amounts of greenhouse gases stored there. But according to new research from Purdue University, the amount of methane released in the atmosphere because of melting permafrost might actually be lower than previously estimated, and we can only hope so. And that's thanks to an unusual ally, a group of methane-loving bacteria called methanotrophs, which consume the gas as an energy source. Methanotrophs live in organic-rich wetland soil in the Arctic, although this environment gives off far more methane than the bugs can consume. But the researchers on the new study discovered brand new species of methanotrophs in Arctic mineral uplands. These soils are drier and contain far less methane, so the new species absorbs the gas from the air and munches on it. Realizing that these microbes hadn't been included in prior calculations, the researchers then added their methane consumption into a biogeochemical model. And sure enough, the methane emission projections dropped. And that's good news because of all the things that are going around in the world, the methane gas emissions is one of the things that actually scares me about the future of our planet's climate, because it has much more potential for really rapidly heating up our atmosphere.
Yeah, Christy, we are super into things that munch other things this week. What was it? Plastic munching on Monday and salt munching yesterday, and today it's methane munching. It's kind of, maybe we're just hungry. I don't know. But all these things that eat other things are great solutions. And it's really fun to kind of explore those discoveries. So thank you so much for reading that. I want to thank everyone for listening to today's Optimist Daily Update. We promise to continue to share positive, solution-based stories with ideas on how you can participate in this changing world and ensure it is change for the good. We promise to continue to cover current events with accuracy, legitimate sources, and offer you the information needed most to chart new paths for all of us.
And please consider becoming an emissary on theoptimistdaily.com. And for just $5 a month, you can support reader-funded independent journalism. Be a part of the solution, changing consciousness, and addressing our world's biggest challenges with a problem-solving mindset.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for turning into some good news. We're excited you're listening, and we are grateful for your solutions.
Thank you so much, world. Talk to you tomorrow.